kept the top of the body immobile, while the footwork dazzled. Grace dances until she is breathless. She wipes her forehead and forearms with a handkerchief. She knows a little Irish. Marjorie outfits Claire and Tom with dark green sweaters she knit for them. "Where did you find the wool?" Grace asks at breakfast. "In a drawer full of sweaters. They must have been jeans. I unraveled one, washed the yarn, and re-knit it to make these." "You have amazing talents," Grace tells her mother. "In my generation, nearly all women were taught to sew and knit. I took home economics, too. It's different when you learn at home. Different when it's a necessity. I lived through the 30s. Yes, but you weren't the one who had to provide." Grace blows across the top of her cup of coffee. "You've been such a help." "You're my life now, just as Claire and Tom are yours." It sounds like a true statement, but it isn't quite. Grace's life is also Jean and Merle's house, and the need to find a job, the necessity to have transportation, the desperation for money, and a desire, varied as it is, for something more. "I'm thinking of taking the children next door," Marjorie says. "I met the neighbor, Maureen. She seemed nice, invited me over. I told her I might have the children with me." "I'm thinking of applying for a job."
"Are you?
If I got a job, would you be able to manage?" She means taking care of the children, cooking the meals, cleaning the house. "I think so. I'd get Aiden to help with the marketing and any heavy work."
"How will you get to work?"
"By bus. Walk if I have to."
"Well, it's only temporary, isn't it? Until Jean gets back."
"Right," says Grace. "Whatever are you going to do for clothes?"
"I'm going to do to Merle's closet what you just did to Jean's drawer."
When Marjorie and the children come home from the visit to Maureen, who turns out to be the cook and not the mistress of the house,
"Such delicious soda bread. We won't need lunch."
They put Claire and Tom down for a nap. Grace, not willing to open Merle's closet without her mother, makes a flourish of it when her mother is beside her.
"Oh, my Lord," Marjorie says. "It's enormous."
Together, they enter the massive closet and stare at the racks and racks of clothes.
"She must have had quite a social life," Marjorie gestures. "Look at all these silks and furs. And this is no mouton coat, I can tell you that," she adds as she holds the arm of a fur.
"I don't know where to start," Grace says.
"You explore while I decide what to have for dinner. Pick out a few things, and I'll see if I can alter them to fit you. You're about the same height, though I'd say Merle had a good 15 pounds on you."
Grace enters the parlor, where Aiden is sitting at the piano. She drops a pile of dresses onto a chair.
"My mother wants to alter these so that I have something to wear when I look for work."
"Where are they from?"
"Merle's closet."
Aiden's sleeves are rolled to his elbows. He hasn't shaved yet.
"You think I shouldn't be doing this," Grace says.
He turns around on the bench.
"No, I think you have to."
"The rules have changed, haven't they?"
"They do in a disaster."
"Is this stealing?" she asks.
"No, not now."
"So what do you think of this one?"
Grace holds the dress by its shoulders against her body. Her mother liked the jade green silk with gold trim at the sleeves and gold buttons. She thought it suited Grace's coloring.
"Where are you going in that?"
Aiden asks, crossing his arms.
"You don't like it."
"It's a little, I don't know, fancy."
Grace whips the dress around and studies the front. She tosses it onto another chair.
"What about this one?"
Aiden tilts his head.
"It's red."
"Yes?"
"And it has polka dots."
So?
Maybe you should choose something a little more conservative.
You're a bore.
Not usually.
She smiles. She rummages through the heap of dresses and reaches for a navy blue with a white collar. She holds it up.
Is your mother good enough to put a waist in it?
Aiden asks. You think it should have a waist?
You have a very nice waist.
Thank you, but this has short sleeves. Too cold for winter. Again, Grace separates out the dresses. She spots a light gray dress with a slim skirt and a little jacket to cover her arms. It's wool, and it will keep her warm. Aiden nods and points. This is it? She asks.
That's what you should wear. Are you nervous?
A little, she says, laying the gray dress on top of the others. She sits on another chair. Do you have a cigarette?
You are nervous.
She pulls a cigarette from his pack and leans his way while he lights it for her. She inhales and rests against the upholstery. Do you get nervous before a concert?
Sometimes I start to sweat. When it's really bad, I get the hiccups.
You can't go on stage with the hiccups. How do you get rid of them?
I find a knife and stick it in a glass of water, put the blunt end of the knife to my forehead, and take 10 slow gulps.
And that works?
Always.
Did you just make that up?
No.
Grace stubs out her cigarette and slides out the green and gold dress, the dress deemed too fancy, from the bottom of the pile on the chair, and begins to dance with it in a free-form movement she makes up as she goes along. Aiden, catching the game, plays waltz music. Grace swoons herself into the dance as if she were wearing the fabric that swirls with her. She waltzes around the parlor, encircling Aiden and the piano. When he switches to the Charleston, Grace holds the dress to her bodice and swings one sleeve back and forth as she executes the footwork of the dance of her mother's generation. Aiden's segue to jazz is Grace's cue to occupy in a languid manner an empty chair, the dress still clinging to her. She pantomimes leaning forward to have her cigarette, in its holder, lit for her. Relaxing into a louche pose, she crosses her legs. Aiden laughs, rolls his sleeves, and draws her into a slow jazz piece she thinks he must have learned at a Harlem nightclub. Merle's closet is enormous. She has dozens of dresses and fur coats, Grace says as she sits with a fancy dress folded over her lap.
Someone should wear those clothes, Aiden says.
There have been pleas for clothing since the fire. Maybe I can get someone to pick them up.
And when your husband comes back, won't he mind that you've given away his mother's clothing without consulting him?
Yes, for a minute, but then he'd see the necessity. If we'd moved in here, which he wanted to do, I suppose I'd have been given the contents of Merle's closet.
Do you see yourself in furs?
Grace laughs. No, can you imagine? Where on earth would I go?
You could come to one of my concerts. You'd be beautiful in a fur.
A blush climbs the sides of her neck. I hated the house when I first came here, she remarks, glancing away.
Why?
My mother-in-law wasn't fond of me. She thought I'd ruined her son.
And did you?
Seen from her point of view, I suppose I did. He was meant to go places. Marry up. In her bedroom, Grace finds a hassock and climbs onto it. She strips down to her slip. In the triple mirror over the dressing table, she can see her reflection. She can't see her head, only the body and the slip. Her skin is pale, the slip hangs from her shoulders, not as fitted as it used to be. Common sense tells Grace that it's her body in the mirrors, but she moves her arm just to make sure. She dips her head down to make double sure. How insubstantial she has become. I've got everything I need, her mother announces as she enters the room. You can get down from there, I have to do the fitting before I can hem anything. Which one did you pick out? Sometimes, as Grace walks the rooms of the large house, she thinks she's won a prize. She thinks she's stolen a prize. In the large kitchen, when she and her mother first entered it, they discovered a wringer washer and a gas clothes dryer. At first, Grace didn't recognize the appliance. It was 3 feet high, 2 feet across, and low to the ground. When she opened the enameled hopper, she learned that there was a metal drum inside. The appliance had only one switch, on or off, and she and her mother concluded after several tries that it took only 15 to 25 minutes to dry a load of wash. Towels and flannels didn't need ironing. She and her mother were amazed. When Grace thought of the time needed to dry sheets in the wet spring, she could only shake her head. Grace is certain that Merle never used the machine. Laundry would have been Clodagh's province.
"They're building tin houses for the homeless," Aiden says that evening as he and Grace are reading in the sitting room.
"How do you know this?"
"I heard it at the post office."
"Is that where you go when the kids are napping?"
"Either there or the market. The houses are temporary until the new ones can be built."
Grace remembers the aluminum clinic. "Won't they be awfully cold?"
"They must have some kind of insulation. They can't be comfortable, but people are desperate to get them."
Grace is silent. "We should be taking in refugees here."
"You already did," he says.
"What do you and Aiden talk about at night?" Marjorie asks Grace the next morning while they are eating oatmeal. Grace stares at her mother. Why this question now?
"We don't talk a lot. We're polite, but mostly we're just reading."
"Reading?"
"Yes," Grace says, avoiding her mother's gaze. She rises to rinse out her tea mug and sees Aiden giving the children a ride on a sled he must have found in the barn out back. Because the barn is farther up the hill than the house, he's able to work up some speed as he sleds down. The children squeal and beg for more. In order to get Tom back up the hill, Aiden puts Claire on the sled and tells her to hold on tight to her brother. Grace watches as Aiden digs in his boots to fit the foot-sized ledges in the snow he's made earlier. It produces the illusion of him climbing a flight of stairs. Grace snatches her wool coat off a hook and steps outside at the front of the house, and for a few minutes, she is free. She slides down the slippery hill of the driveway, crosses the coast road, stumbles through the brush, and arrives at the beach. In her haste, she forgot her gloves and hat. Her ears sting. She puts her hands into her coat pockets, where she finds a quarter. Where did that come from? The sea has a chop to it that produces a deep blue green. Living on the water is like watching a movie in color. She happens upon a large rock and sits on it, and covers her ears until her hands are too cold. She's not sure she's ever been this happy, with her children and her mother safely in a large house, with Aiden to help and to talk to. She remembers sitting at her kitchen table at Hunt's Beach, smoking a cigarette and staring at the sink. How lonely and grim that seems now.
"You forgot your hat and gloves."
Aiden settles the hat on her head and hands her the gloves, and she realizes she wished him here.
"Thanks," she says, glancing up at him. "My ears were stinging."
"It's pretty cold out," he says,
drawing his black wool coat tighter. He claps his gloved hands together. He wears a black watch cap.
"The children are in?" she asks.
"Tom got a snoot full of snow and started to cry. I had to take them to your mother."
"It looked like fun."
"They're wonderful."
Grace smiles.
"I agree."
He stands beside her, staring out to sea. Perhaps he's as mesmerized by the chop as she is. It makes the ocean seem alive. I'm always amazed that we're not looking at England, but at Portugal, she says. And it's warmer in London than it is here.
The Gulf Stream, they say simultaneously.
Do you ever wish you could go back to Ireland? She asks.
In the war, I went to every Allied country on the European front, which didn't include Ireland or Switzerland because of their neutrality. Yes, I'd like to go back there sometime. I still have brothers there.
Do you? Grace asks, surprised.
Two of them. They were older than I, and more settled when we left.
It must have been painful for your mother to leave them.
My parents planned to save money for their passage, but the oldest refused to leave, and the other followed suit.
I can't imagine growing up in a large family. I was an only child.
How old are you?
24, Grace answers. You?
29 last September.
So you just travel from place to place whenever they need a pianist?
I've done it all, he says. Taught music in school, soloed with orchestras, tried to put some bands together.
You don't mind not having a place to call home?
I didn't used to.
It's wonderful to have such dedication, Grace says.
It's a gift. I won't deny that. But I admire you.
What for? She asks, squinting up at him.
Finding a safe place for your family. Keeping life sane when you must be worried sick about your husband.
After dinner, Grace meanders into the sitting room with her book and is glad to see Aiden there. I'll go out tomorrow and start looking for a job, she announces. There's a bus I can take.
Where will you start?
She tilts her head. I'll tell you when I get one.
I'm breathless with anticipation.
She reaches a leg out and kicks his boot. How is your search going? She asks.
I've half a dozen queries out. We'll see what comes of them.
Where are you looking? She asks. She notes his knitted vest of brown wool. Hand-knit. A mother? A lover? A sister? A wife?
Boston, New York, Chicago, Baltimore.
So far away? He sits up straight and clears his throat.
I've got to go where there are orchestras.
What are you reading? She asks.
It's a biography of Antonin Dvorak.
She doesn't know who Antonin Dvorak is.
He was a Czech composer. Brahms was his mentor. What are you reading?
The plays of Eugene O'Neill. I found the volume in the bookcase beside you. Right now I'm reading something called The Iceman Cometh. He nods. You know it?
Yes.
I try to picture the play as I read it, she says. O'Neill was Irish-American.
Are you enjoying them?
He's very dark and full of pain.
Our national heritage.
Are you dark and full of pain? She means it as a joke.
Sometimes.
Grace's evening conversations with Aiden often end abruptly. She wants to tell him, ask him, so much more. But like in her exchanges with Jean, they talk in bits. Unlike her exchanges with Jean, the bits fascinate her. Grace removes a pile of papers from a drawer in Merle's bedroom and sets them on the bed next to her as she sits up, her back to the headboard, to find out how the house is run and what the bills might be. The date, 1947, is affixed to the first page by a paperclip, and after that the papers had no obvious organization. She locates an invoice for shoe repair under an account for electricity, but there's no indication as to whether either of these has been settled. No dunning notices, no checkbook. Did Merle pay only in cash? Sending it through the mail? Grace unearths a breathtaking statement for a bracelet containing 10 one-carat diamonds in gold. She hasn't come across a bracelet of that description, and imagines that Merle squirreled her best jewelry in a hiding place.
perhaps a safety deposit box. Several doctor's bills are clipped together. First, those of Dr. Franklin, then of a cancer specialist, then from the hospital. Was Merle supposed to pay these as she lay dying? There has to have been a will, accounts with a bank. Jean would know about these. It's odd he never mentioned anything but the house. She comes up with an invoice from Best & Company in Boston for 4 dresses with detailed descriptions. Satin belt with paste clasp. Navy wool skirt cut on the bias. Blush pink silk fortuny skirt with 36 pleats. Mink hat, turban style, lined with royal purple silk. Where did Merle go in these clothes? Would she have worn the fortuny silk to a cocktail party? The skirt cut on the bias to play bridge? The satin dress with paste clasp to a winter wedding? At the bottom of the pile are 3 bills clipped together, each dated a subsequent month, for a case of Edgerton Pink Gin. O'Neill's words swim on the page. Across from her, Aiden has on a striped shirt and a black V-neck sweater. She notes onyx cufflinks. She catches these details in quick glances. She reaches into her pocket and pulls out her cigarettes. She leans forward an inch to ask if he would like one, but then notes his pack, Camels, and a box of matches on the table next to him. She wishes she could read the name of the restaurant on the front cover. Is it from New York or St. Louis? His shoe jiggles once. She takes a long drag. There's so much she never noticed about this room. The Delft clock, an array of silver boxes atop a desk, a darkened portrait of an important man. No, a self-important man. But then, it was for the painter to say, wasn't it? The man in the picture might have been told to stand with his chin elevated, his fingers inside his buttoned coat. In his other hand, he holds a book, a fact that changes her idea of both the man and the painter. A book, not a Bible, suggests learning as opposed to commerce. When she glances down from the portrait, Aiden is staring at her. She smiles slightly. "Have you had a good day?" he asks. "Yes. At least I think so. I can hardly remember it."
"You're a busy woman."
"I suppose I am. I was looking at that painting and trying to decide what the man did for a living." He turns to examine the picture.
"A reader, certainly. Perhaps a teacher who thinks a lot of himself. I suppose your husband must be related to the man."
"What era do you think it's from?"
"Judging from the clothes and mustache, mid to late 19th century. He could have been your husband's grandfather."
"You'll have your portrait done," she says.
"Why do you say that?"
"You'll be an important musician, and someone will want to do a painting of you."
"A photograph for a poster, maybe."
"I was thinking that there's so much talent in your hands." She has seen his fingers move so fast, they created a blur as she watched.
"There has to be dexterity," he concedes. "But they're only producing what's in the brain."
"All that music in the brain. It must be full up." He laughs.
"There's room for plenty more."
Grace tries her book again, but reads the same sentence 3 times. "Have you ever been married?" she asks, pulling a piece of lint from her powder blue sweater.
"No. My work doesn't lend itself to marriage. I travel too much. Work nights."
Her hand trembles as she turns another page. She lays her fingers hard against the open book. Does she only imagine the connection between them? Not that of landlady and lodger, though they are that. Not that of mutual refugees from a catastrophe, though they are that too. And not merely friends, or even friends, as she and Rosie are to each other. Grace is married. Why does she keep forgetting that? She thinks that her body, if it could, might speak. "Touch my hand.
Let me touch your hand. Put your hand at the back of my neck. Nothing more. Her body can't ask for more. Her mother called him handsome. The straight brow and the eyes, a soft brown. His hair curls slightly and then doesn't, as if it can't make up its mind. His mouth is straight and hard, not cruel in any way, but serious. Yes, she would say he has a serious mouth.
I like this house, he says.
You do?
I'm a man of hotel rooms. This is grand, isn't it?
I suppose so. It housed a woman who hated me, but I've come to appreciate it without having to think about her.
Even children couldn't break the ice?
Apparently not.
Your husband must have been torn.
Yes, he was. But was he? Maybe not. How might her life have been different if she hadn't married Jean? Would she be a secretary now? An unmarried daughter living with her mother? Might she have met someone who truly loved her?
What are you thinking?
He asks.
You look pensive.
Should she tell him? I was wondering what my life might have been like had I not met Jean when I did. But then I quickly realized I wouldn't have my children as they are, and that was the end of that. He is silent. Do you imagine alternate lives for yourself? She asks.
No, not really. I can't see having another life. I wouldn't want one.
You've worked too hard.
Something like that.
She watches him return to his reading. Do the words swim on the page for him? She lights a second cigarette. If she keeps this up, she'll become a chain smoker. A year ago, Grace discovered, during a hectic morning, that she'd left a cigarette burning on the edge of the bathroom sink while another was going in an ashtray in the kitchen, and the realization shook her. She vowed to be more careful. Again, she looks over at Aiden and discovers he is again staring at her. She smiles, and he looks away. She crosses her legs, aware of a silky rustle. She puts out her cigarette. She ought to go up.
What are your plans for tomorrow?
He asks. Pretty much the same as today. I thought I'd start looking for work, but they say the storm we're expecting will be a bad one. I don't want to leave my mother with the kids alone.
I'll be here, he says.
Thank you, but I think I'll start looking on Monday. Fresh start. He rolls his sleeves, and she can see from the dial on his watch that it's well after 9. She would stay until 1 a.m. if he asked her to. He does want her to stay. She can feel it. But after another minute, Aiden says,
I suppose I'll take my book to bed now.
Good night, then, she says. He stands and is careful not to brush against her. She feels bereft even before he has left the room. Grace lies on her four-poster, the children asleep in the room with her. She stares at the ceiling and feels heat rise and then drain from her face. She wants to put her mouth to Aiden's skin. She wants him to run his fingers through her hair. That's all. Does there have to be more? There must, because she wouldn't feel like this. She understands that the act might be wrong, but the desire for it is not. In the morning, Grace bundles the children into their winter woolens, and together she and Claire walk down the gravel lane. Grace shows Tom, in her arms, the ocean. She wonders if he remembers it from the night of the fire, if he will always carry with him a vestigial love for or fear of the sea. What will the hideous night do to Claire? Or did the fact that their mother held them tight through the natural horrors give them a protective coating that will serve them well? The snow crust has grown soft, which makes walking easier. Grace reminds Claire to look both ways before they cross the coast road, even though there hasn't been a vehicle on it for half an hour. On the other side,
They struggle over low, prickly bushes, cut grass, and mounds of snow-covered sand. Claire loses a boot, which Grace finds and puts over Claire's wet sock. Because the tide is low, the beach gravel and the sea's leavings are plentiful. When she was a girl, Grace used to search for sea glass among the pebbles. She shows Claire what to look for, and notes as she does that there are hundreds of emeralds strewn among the debris. When she bends to look, she discovers they are small bits of emerald sea glass, each the size of a stone in a ring. There are no other colors that day, no other shapes. It's not a configuration she's ever seen before. What caused this unique and even offering?
Claire, she says, see these little bits? They're sea jewels, very valuable. Let's look for them and put them in this handkerchief, and when we go back, we'll make jewelry.
Claire's eyes widen. She has seen the strings of jewelry hanging from her mother's dressing table. Grace sets Tom on a tuft of sand right next to them, and as she searches for emeralds herself, she keeps a close eye on Claire. But her daughter seems to have intuited that jewels are not to be eaten. She can't pick the emeralds up with her mittens, so drops the knitted items where she stands, and grasps as many bits of color as she can find. When she hands the treasures to her mother to put into the handkerchief, there are just as many pebbles as pieces of sea glass. Tom has a shell that occupies him. Grace stands to stretch her legs and glances up at the house on the hill, which she has never seen from this vantage point. She catches Aiden, hands in his pockets, looking at her and the children. She waves. She kneels next to her daughter. When they have collected all the gems that will fit into the handkerchief, Claire's fingers are red with cold. Grace ties up the bundle and puts it into her pocket.
Let's get your mittens on and go up and make some jewelry. We'll ask Grammy how to do it.
Tom, who has poured a shell full of beach over his face, has sand stuck to his nostrils and tongue. Grace hefts him into her arms and glances up again at the turret window. Aiden isn't there. In a drawer of odds and ends in Merle's room, Grace finds an old brooch, most of its seed pearls missing. When she brings it downstairs, she asks her mother if she has come across any glue. Her mother knows of some in the sewing basket upstairs. Grace and Claire bend over the brooch, gluing the emeralds that haven't stuck to Claire's fingers against the silver backing. While they are working, Aiden enters the kitchen to pick up a sandwich that Grace's mother has made for him. Aiden asks Claire what she's doing, and Claire answers she's making
Julie.
Grace smiles. In the afternoon, Aiden asks Marjorie if it would be all right if he practiced through the afternoon. She says yes, especially if he'll help her get the children's beds up to the third floor nursery, where they will sleep better. Grace, who has been listening from the bottom of the stairs, watches Aiden carry first the collapsible playpen, then the crib across the landing. Her mother follows with bedding. Sitting out of sight of Aiden, Grace listens while he plays. It's the same piece he was practicing when she entered Merle Holland's house, and she has physical sensations similar to the ones she had that day. Occasionally, Aiden breaks off and repeats a passage, or he trills up and down the piano, practicing scales. Then he launches into a later part of the concerto. Grace lays her head against the back of the chair and travels with him. After Grace has finished the dishes and put the children to bed, she hesitates as she descends the stairs. In seconds, she'll walk into the sitting room with her book. Does Aiden look forward to these evenings as much as she does? When she turns the corner and sees him sitting in his usual chair, her relief is almost audible.
How did the brooch come out?
He asks as she sits.
Pretty good. Well, you know. Did you hear anything back from your inquiries?
Yes, I did.
Grace looks up.
I have an audition with the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
A fist strikes her chest. That's wonderful news. When did you hear?
When I went to the post office this afternoon.
Oh, she says, registering the implications of the audition. When is it?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow? So soon?
They need someone right away.
She closes her book. That's why you were practicing all afternoon.
I hope I didn't keep the kids from their naps.
She notices that he didn't bring his book to the sitting room. They were fine.
Grace, I've enjoyed my time here.
Stop, she wants to say. She hates his elegiac tone, his building up to a farewell. He stands and begins to pace. He walks the length of the sitting room and back again. How will you get to Boston? She asks.
By train.
It might snow tonight.
It might.
It looked like it this afternoon, she adds. If it snows tonight, the trains might not run.
Perhaps not.
Only the reading lights illuminate the room. When he walks to the far side, she can barely see him. Time and time again, he returns to her. When he's tired of pacing, he leans against a wall.
I don't want to leave here, he says. I don't want to leave you.
She says lightly, maybe I'll come to one of your concerts.
In a fur coat, he says.
She'll never go to one of his concerts. She can barely afford the bus fare to look for work, never mind a trip to Boston. And she could hardly take the kids with her, nor would she ever dare to wear one of Merle's furs. She's done enough damage to her mother-in-law's closet. Besides, isn't it now her role in life to wait for her husband to come home?
Maybe I'll get back this way, he says.
When? In 3 months? 6? A year? 2? Her head is bent, and she knows he's studying her. She's afraid to look up. It will be her undoing. She bites her lower lip.
If I play the piano softly, will I wake your mother? He asks.
They're back up on the third floor tonight. After hauling all the equipment up there for the naps, it seemed too much trouble to bring it all back down. He takes her hand and leads her into the turreted parlor. She sits on one of the audience chairs. His playing is subdued, so as not to wake anyone. The notes tickle her skin and soothe her mind. He's trying to tell her something, and she understands it. She does, though there aren't any words attached. Music doesn't translate. She feels the chords envelop her, but not in the way a mother might hold a child. 4 sconces light the room. She imagines Aiden on a stage in evening clothes. That will be his world. This man who will make men and women sit up and listen. The music is both commanding and sensual. No child could ever make sense of this embrace. It's something she's longed for, longs for even now. The music rises to a crescendo and then falls as softly as a pillow. She closes her eyes and lets the piano take her somewhere she's never been. This is what they will have, these next several minutes, these next few measures. She knows she'll remember it always, that if in the future she hears a snippet of this music, she'll be transported to this room, this evening. She opens her eyes and studies him as he plays. His gaze seems to be focused on a distant point out to sea, and only occasionally does he glance at his hands. She wants to absorb every note, every combination of notes. She wants it all, especially the intimacy of it. It's not the god-awful joy that Rosie once spoke of, but it must be close. Or perhaps this is an even grander sensation, one she will never be able to explain to her friend. Grace wishes she and Aiden had never spoken,
from the first day she met him until now. How wonderful if they had communicated only by music every one of the 9 days they have had together. She wouldn't have seen that he was good with the children, or that he could make her smile with his charm. She wouldn't know who Dvorak was. But every night, he would have done this to her as she sat in her chair, helpless and spellbound. He plays, and she drifts along the curvature of the earth. He plays, and her body is flooded with gratitude. He plays, and she understands that the end is coming. When he stops, she can't speak. Words will break the trance, will sound trivial and trite. She'd have to wish him good luck, and he'd return the phrase. Perhaps he'd tell her that he would write to her, and everything they had just experienced would be punctured by the commonplace. When he walks by her, he holds out his hand. Wordlessly, in the dark of the library, he lights a candle by the bed. The music has already undressed her, so that the removal of the sweater and skirt, the brassiere and slip, the girdle and her stockings, seems unremarkable. When she is naked, he gazes at her in the low light, and she isn't ashamed. He drapes the sheets back, and she slides into the bed, the sheets silky and smooth. She does what she has wanted to do for so long. She bares her neck as she drapes herself across his body, and he kisses her there, allowing her to kiss his skin. He touches her everywhere, sliding his hand down her calf to her foot, running his hand from her breast down her flank. Neither says a word. Inside her head, the music is still playing, or perhaps this is an entirely new piece, one with more urgency, the beat faster, the fingers flying. He pauses to protect himself, to protect her, and he slides into her with ease. As he raises himself up by his arms, his eyes scan her face. She shifts her hips and arches her back to take him in. She grips his back. Another man might say that he loved her, but Grace doesn't need that. Aiden is slow, holding back, and she experiences the buildup of a different kind of crescendo. She feels it rise up through her toes to the insides of her thighs, a crescendo with many more notes in it than any piece of music, one that continues to climb, and she knows that he can see the moment of her intense pleasure, which feels like liquid flooding through her veins. She's certain she said something, an ecstatic word in a language all her own, a word that causes him to focus on his own crescendo. His eyes fix on hers. He makes his own sound and bends his head. He pulls her toward him, so that her head rests in the crook of his arm. She floats, placid and perfect. His breathing changes, and she knows the moment he loses consciousness. She thinks it lovely to have him sleeping beside her, as if they were indeed a couple, as if they had all the time in the world. She will leave him before he wakes so that there will be no need to say goodbye. For the first time in a week, Grace sleeps so deeply that when she opens her eyes, the children are already up. She puts on her robe and runs downstairs. "He's gone," her mother says. Grace is silent. "He took his suitcase." Again, she doesn't speak. "He stripped his bed," her mother adds. Snow. Against the windows, the snow falls in dry sheets. The wind thumps at the front of the house, and from some of the rooms Grace can hear it howl. She prepares a fire, but won't light it until the power goes out, nearly inevitable in a nor'easter. Her mother collects all the candles she can find and sets them in holders or sticks them to dessert plates by lighting the wicks and letting hot wax drip to the dishes. Grace checks the cupboards and refrigerator for food and supplies and decides that Aiden has done a good job of provisioning the house. They can live on what they have for at least 5 days. Aiden. She puts her forehead to the cold glass of the window. She wants to howl like the wind. She won't wash Aiden's sheets until the storm is over. If she did, and the machine stopped mid-wash, the linens would be coated with soap for days. Alone, in a darkened corner, she lifts the bundle to her face. She can smell Aiden on them. Would she be able to smell herself? She is tempted to look for evidence of their time together, but she drops the sheets to the floor. She pictures the train he was on moving away from the storm as it made its way toward Boston. There, she imagines, he will walk to his audition if he can't find a taxi. She glances at her watch. 11:20. How many hours since he made love to her? 13? By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 2 feet of snow has fallen. When the sun sets, 3 feet push against the sides of the house. All day, Grace has been shoveling to keep the steps and a short path clear, though what good it will do them, she can't imagine. It's a path to nowhere, not to a car, not to the street. She supposes she ought to have shoveled to the barn, but for what purpose? She has a wild and desperate urge to put on her coat and hat and gloves and slide down to the street and walk south in hopes of catching a ride to Boston. Can it be done? The snow is too deep, and she wouldn't be able to tell the road from the beach. She might wander into the sea. She might lose her balance in the blizzard and fall into a snowbank and die there. She has children. The onset of evening begins well enough. The snow has been steady, but by 7 o'clock, the wind picks up again, and shortly after that, the electricity stops. A tree, perhaps weakened by the fire, has fallen onto an electric wire. "We're in it now," her mother says. Grace tucks Claire into a soft armchair and sees apprehension in her daughter's face.
Mommy, stay next to me.
Grace kneels on the floor to rub her daughter's back until she falls asleep. Grace has made a nest for Tom and herself with a pile of rugs on the floor in front of the fire screen. She makes up a bed for her mother on the sofa. The high upholstered back will help to capture the heat. There's a fair amount of wood on the back porch, her mother says. I hope it outlasts the power outage. It has to. Grace then remembers the water pipes. In the kitchen, she turns on the tap at the sink, running as little water as possible, but keeping the flow steady. She doesn't want the pipes to burst in what will shortly become a frozen house. She does a similar thing with all the faucets in the bathrooms, making sure there are no stoppers in the sinks and tubs, and when she ventures down into the basement, candle in hand, she discovers a large sink with a faucet. We have the stove for warmth when we need it, Grace says to her mother. Refrigeration won't be a problem, at least not yet. Wish we'd listened to the radio before the power went out. Then we might know how long it will snow for. What good would that have done? Grace asks herself. It's not as though they have somewhere else to go. She remembers the families in the tin houses. Electricity only, and when that went, she hopes the people were evacuated before the storm got rough. Despite exhaustion, Grace periodically untangles herself from the nest, lights a candle, and brings a pile of wood into the sitting room via a red wagon her mother found in the nursery. Because the journey is cold, she works fast to build up a good fire. When she's done, she holds the top blanket close to the fire screen and then lays it over Tom and herself. The four eat in the kitchen, their hats and jackets on, the warmth from the stove saving the room from being intolerably cold. Marjorie prepares oatmeal, determined to get a hot breakfast into them.
She warms the maple syrup, which is as thick as sludge from the cold, and pours it over the cereal. Marjorie urges Grace to eat an entire bowl. This is no time to be fussy about food. Grace wants to tell her mother that her lack of appetite has nothing to do with fussiness. I have an idea, Marjorie announces to Grace. The sitting room is massive, and the heat dissipates. We could move into the library instead, which is smaller. There's a fireplace and a bed. You could sleep there with both the children, and we could bring in the sofa and put it against the wall, and I'll sleep there. If we shut the door, we'll be fine. Grace experiences her mother's proposition as a gift. To sleep in Aiden's bed is to stay connected to him, if only for a few more days. I'll find some clean sheets, her mother burbles happily. And we have plenty of blankets. We'd better bring in toys for the children and books to read by candlelight. In the library, Grace starts a fire in the grate. She and her mother drag the sofa in. Her mother makes up the two beds so that they are ready for evening, though it is only 10 in the morning. After Grace gathers her small family into the library, she wants to lie on the bed and think of Aiden. She changes the children's clothing and then enters the frigid bathroom just off the library to change her own. It's so cold she doesn't want to sit on the toilet seat. She has brought from Merle's closet a wool sweater, pants, and a scarf. After she wraps her coat around her and puts on her gloves, she places Merle's mink turban on her head. There's a great deal of wood to bring in and to store just outside the library door. From her mother-in-law's closet, she's taken the warmest and smallest items she could find for her mother. Marjorie swims in the mink jacket but doesn't refuse it. Before Grace leaves the bathroom, she opens the medicine cabinet to see if Aiden left anything behind. But the metal shelves are empty. By 11 o'clock in the morning, Grace, Claire, and Tom have made a fort out of all the pillows and cushions. They play in it in woolen coats, as if they were outside and making an igloo. Marjorie has braved the frigid kitchen to bring spoons and small plates, so that Grace and Claire can delineate the kitchen from the living room. Tom, delighted to be playing with his mother's and sister's full attention, crawls and rolls and delivers deep belly laughs. He sits on plates and knocks over cushions, eliciting his sister's fury. When it's time for their naps, Grace crawls into the fort, her legs sticking out, and reads them stories. She, too, falls asleep with her head in the kitchen. Grace stumbles, snowblind, outside. She squints in the bright sun. The world is covered in white, which seems, with its crusty surface, to be a heavy blanket of sparks stretching as far as she can see. Even the ocean has frozen near the shoreline, and she can see blue water only 100 feet out to sea. These blasts from nature that make it so hard to live are sometimes beautiful. The fire, in its essence, was sublime. The quiet world around her, covered in snow, is as still as glass. The beauty makes her miss Aiden with an ache that feels unbearable. She replays the night they had together, moment by moment. Will she spend her life missing him? Two boys with shovels call to her from the bottom of the long driveway. She can't hear them, but she nods vigorously. Whatever they will charge her when they make it to the top, she'll pay. She steps inside the house to search for stray coins. The silence in the house is haunting. The music, which was magical, has vanished. When she entered the old Victorian, she heard the piano and Aiden playing it. The loss is in her skin, along her backbone. Grace takes the children out to see the magic blanket. Tom claps his mittened hands and laughs. Claire steps into the snow, which swallows her. To help Claire, Grace sets Tom, for just a moment, onto the shoveled path, itself now deep in snow. She stops Claire's tears by making a snowball and teaching her to throw it. Turning, Grace discovers Tom face down in the snow. She brushes him off and sits with him on the stoop. Claire makes tiny, ineffectual snowballs that barely dent the white blanket. The following day, the power returns, but it's an hour before anyone notices. It's only when Grace rounds the corner to the sitting room with a reading lamp lit that she sees Aiden in his usual chair. She gasps with happiness. He's returned to her. The illusion lasts only a second, however. She covers her eyes and bends forward to protect what little self she has left. After a few minutes, she enters the kitchen and flips all the switches. "Oh, thank God," her mother says. Grace might say the same, though she is fizzy with longing. That evening, Grace and her mother wash all the bedding, dry it, and remake the beds. The children seem to like sleeping on the third floor with their toys and their Grammy. Marjorie is pleased, and Grace is relieved. She needs a night to herself. In her room, Merle's room, she turns the light on in the closet to look for warmer clothes suitable for job hunting in the snow. She happens upon a brown wool suit, half hidden and overshadowed by the more beautiful dresses surrounding it. She tries on the jacket and decides that if she wears a sweater under it, it will fit her. The skirt, however, is too wide. Grace takes the skirt to the bed, examines it, and realizes that it has an elastic waist. If she gently gathers the elastic, she can make the skirt work. It will have bulges at the hips, but the jacket will cover them. She removes the brown skirt from its hanger and sits with it on the bed. While studying the hem, she feels hard lumps inside the wool. Weights. Women sometimes put them in the hems of thick material to give a skirt more drape. With a pair of snipping scissors from the dressing table, Grace begins to cut the stitches of the hem. After a foot, Grace tilts the skirt so that the weights will fall out. Instead of a weight, however, a ring falls into her palm. Grace drops it onto the bedspread as if it had singed her. A large sapphire is surrounded by diamonds in a gold setting. The ring is too big for Grace, but she isn't at all interested in the fit. Instead, she's curious about why Merle felt it necessary to hide it in the hem of a dull brown skirt. She shakes all the weights out of the hem. There are six rings, a large diamond set in gold, a silver dinner ring with a massive emerald, a ruby surrounded by pearls, another diamond ring, this one set with two sapphires on either side, and a large ruby, multifaceted, in a gold setting. Grace lays them out side by side on the bedspread. Apart from movie reels of Jewish refugees hiding their valuables in their coats, Grace has never heard of such a thing. Did Merle not trust her staff? Hundreds of dollars worth of jewelry dot the bedspread. Did Jean know about this? Did Merle tell Jean as she lay on her deathbed? To think that Grace might so easily have taken Merle's clothes to the Salvation Army. Did Merle undo her own hems when she wanted to wear the sapphire and diamond ring? Was the large diamond her engagement ring, put away after her husband died? More curious still, are there other treasures hiding in the wardrobe? Grace stands and paces Merle's room, glancing from time to time at the gems on the bedspread. She slips a cigarette from the pack in her pocket, lights it, and inhales deeply. With the rings alone, she would have a deposit for a house for her mother. Grace could buy a car. But the treasure on the bed is contraband. It doesn't belong to her. If anything, it belongs to Jean, and until Jean is declared dead, if he did indeed die, it's his to keep or to sell. But does she really believe this? If she has assumed that the house is hers by right of marriage to a missing husband, isn't she entitled to its contents as well? No. Sleeping in Merle's house was an act of desperation. Selling her jewelry is a tacit admission that Grace's husband is dead.